You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And a special greetings to our this week's new affiliates. We're going to we've been kind of doing them on day by day as they go through. I'm going to just start doing them on Fridays. U-Central TV out of the University of Central Oklahoma carrying our show. Puget Sound Access covering Auburn, Berrien, Kent, Brenton, SeaTac, Tukwila, again, King County, Washington. BTV Access, also known as Bridgewater Television in Bridgewater, Massachusetts. And KMAS FM, 104.1 in Olympia, Washington. So greetings to all of you who may be encountering our show for the very first time. This being Friday, we always start the hour, the show. Our first hour was Brunch with Bernie, our one-hour national town hall meeting with the guy that I think of as America's senator, although Vermonters know that he is their senator, Senator Bernie Sanders. Senator Sanders, welcome.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you here. So what's on your schedule for this week?
There's a lot that's going on, and let me just briefly go over them. Unemployment figures came out today, and they were mixed. The official unemployment rate went down to 7.5%. That's the good news. The bad news is that the real unemployment rate rose to 13.9%. And the point here is that the government uses a number of indices to determine what unemployment is. The official unemployment rate does not include those people who have given up looking for work and those people who are working part-time when they want to work full-time. So the truer indicator of real unemployment is what we call the U6 index, and that's at 13.9%, and something that should be of real concern to all of us. I am especially concerned and hope to get into this a little bit more with youth unemployment, Tom. At a time when we have millions of people who are looking for work and can't find jobs, probably the hardest hit groups are young people, and those are people just graduating high school, or people graduating college, often with large debts. So creating the millions of jobs that this country desperately needs should be at the very top of our agenda. We've got to stay focused on that issue. Some good news is that in the state of Maine, Maine became this week the 13th state in the country to go on record in favor of a constitutional amendment to reverse the disastrous Citizens United decision. And this is an issue that for anyone concerned about American democracy and trying to combat the huge impact that big money has on the political process, the fact that Citizens United and the Supreme Court said that if you're a billionaire or a large corporation, you can spend as much money as you want on an election. If we want to turn that back, we need a constitutional amendment. I've offered that amendment. Some others have as well. And Maine just came on board that issue. Also, I think many listeners know that what sequestration is about, a very, very poor way, a bad way to do deficit reduction. One of the areas that I am concerned about is that programs like Meals on Wheels and congregate meal programs for seniors have seen significant cuts. We have a lot of pain in the senior community, a lot of folks who have a hard time buying the food that they need, paying for their prescription drugs, heating their homes, taking care of the basic necessities of life. We should not be cutting back on Meals on Wheels, and this is an issue that I intend to address in the coming weeks. There's another issue I wanted to touch on, and it was highlighted, I think, by a piece in the New York Times today, indicating there are a number of investigations going on against J.P. Morgan Chase, the largest financial institution in the country. But what we should appreciate is that virtually every single major financial institution in this country has engaged in fraud of one point or another. And I think it is fair to say that at a time when the financial institutions are so huge, you got six financial institutions, if you can believe this, having assets equivalent to two-thirds of the gross domestic product of the United States of America. I mean, that's just extraordinary. Yeah. What that means in terms of power, what it means in terms of wealth, and every single one of these financial institutions has grown larger since we bailed them out because they were too big to fail. But if you look at all of them, whether it's J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, Citigroup, Wells Fargo, Goldman Sachs, all of these have at one point or another in recent years paid very substantial fines for breaking the law. So the question that has to be raised, and we had a town meeting here a few weeks ago with Matt Taibbi, who I know is on your show occasionally.
Yeah.
And Matt writes about Wall Street. And the real question that we have to ask is whether fraud is the business model of Wall Street. Whether it's not, you know, every company is going to make a mistake, every person makes a mistake, but is fraud, deliberate cheating, the business model of Wall Street? I think you could probably make a case that it is. But bottom line here is that I and others, a few of us, are working on a very, very important issue, and that is the need to break up these huge financial institutions which have so much economic power over our nation and so much political power as well. So that's an issue that I think we should focus on. Another issue that also you and I have talked about is the issue of media concentration. You know, if you try to understand as a nation where we are and how we know what goes on, what should be frightening to all Americans is there really is not a diversity of viewpoints out there in media. You have increasingly a small number of large media conglomerates who own and control what the American people see, hear, and read. And that concentration control has grown very substantially in recent years. You have companies like Comcast, Disney, Time Warner, News Corp, Viacom, CBS, Rupert Murdoch's company, News Corp, controlling a very, very significant amount of the information in this country. President Obama has named a gentleman named Tom Wheeler to be his new chairman of the FCC. And I wrote to Mr. Wheeler expressing my concerns about media consolidation and wanting to know his views on that terribly important issue. And there's legislation that we have on the books called cross-ownership, prohibiting one company from owning a more than a certain amount of television stations, radio stations, and newspapers in a given community. And there has been an effort for many years to try to soften that so that one company can really control almost the entire flow of information in a given media market. And that's something we want to stay on and see how Mr. Wheeler feels about before I cast my vote on that issue. So those are some of the issues that are out there.
Yeah, that's quite a collection. And on the media consolidation, it looks like the Koch brothers actually are trying to get in on that game, possibly looking at the
that's
trading
right.
companies.
That is, it's a slightly different issue, but an issue of huge consequence. As I'm sure you have discussed on the show, the Koch family, which is two guys that are worth $25 billion apiece, a total of $50 billion, one of the wealthiest families in America. And I think as many listeners know, they have been extremely involved in right-wing politics, extreme right-wing politics. They have contributed hundreds of millions of dollars as a result of Citizens United into the recent 2012 campaign. I expect that those huge contributions will continue. They have set up and contributed and funded many, many so-called think tanks, right-wing think tanks, who have the goal of cutting taxes for the rich, destroying Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid and so forth. And now they want to own the Tribune Company's newspapers. And that would be a very dangerous development.
15 minutes past the hour. It's our brunch with Bernie, our Senator Bernie Sanders, taking your calls right after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Brunch with Bernie, our national town hall meeting. Check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov. Welcome back to Talk Media for the Sane Among Us, the Tom Hartman Radio and TV program. And it's our Brunch with Bernie hour. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us, taking your calls in our national town hall meeting. Neil in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Senator Sanders. It's a pleasure to talk to you. My question is,
why aren't the Democrats going after the Republicans? I mean, I know everything's about diplomacy, but why aren't they not going after them on their lack of patriotism and and ethics and morals when they don't seem to care about the infrastructure of this country? They don't seem to care about jobs. They've filibustered every single jobs bill, every single infrastructure bill. They seem more obsessed with abortion than they are with the health of this country. I mean, why aren't the Democrats going after them, like really seriously going after them?
Well, Neil, that's a great question, and I share your analysis, and I would make that criticism of the president as well. I think what we have to understand, there are different ways that you can do politics, especially in the political moment that we're in right now. And I think what people have to appreciate is that in the House of Representatives, and everybody understands that to get legislation passed, you got to get through the Senate, the House, and it's signed by the president. Right now, in the House of Representatives, you have a majority, the Republican majority, which is working night and day to protect the wealthiest people in this country. And in answer to the previous question is, dealing with Ryan and sequestration, what these guys believe, this is what they believe. We have a serious deficit problem, which we do. The deficit was caused by the wars that Bush got us into, tax breaks for the rich, and the deregulation of Wall Street and the financial crisis and less revenue coming in. Those are the causes of deficit reduction. What all of these guys want to do is balance the budget on the backs of the elderly, cutting Social Security, doing away with Medicare as we know it, massive cuts in Medicaid, cuts in education, cuts in environmental protection, nutrition programs. That's what they believe. And this whole fight over sequestration was, do the wealthiest people in this country who are doing phenomenally well, and at a time when we have growing wealth and income inequality, do you ask them to stop paying their fair share of taxes? Do you do away with the loopholes that corporations now enjoy so that one out of four major corporations not paying a nickel in taxes? These guys are stashing their money in the Cayman Islands and Bermuda and other tax havens, and the Republicans are saying, that's fine, not a problem. But we must cut Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and education. So to get back to Neil's question, the issue is, given that reality, there are two approaches to dealing with that. Number one, you could say, okay, hey, Republicans control the House. We're going to have to deal with that reality, even though those views are way, way, way outside of what the American people support. So you could do what President Obama did and say, okay, I'm going to give you what you guys have wanted for years. I am going to make cuts in Social Security through the so-called chain CPI. I am going to do corporate tax reform, deficit neutral, not bringing in any more revenue. I'm going to raise premiums on people on Medicare who make more than $47,000. And I hope you Republicans, with me having given you all that, I hope you Republicans will now work with me. Now, that's one approach. I think that's a failed approach. And not only the president, but a number of Democrats take that approach. What's the alternative? The alternative is to speak truth to the American people and say, look, middle class is disappearing. Poverty is just extremely high. We have 14% of our people are unemployed. The rich are getting richer. Large corporations are enjoying record-breaking profits. And you know what? We are not going to do deficit reduction on the backs of the most vulnerable. And I need the American people to stand with me, working families to stand with me, to say we're going to create millions of jobs for our young people and for all workers. We're going to deal with global warming because it's a serious, serious problem. And we are going to take on the Republicans. And the way you defeat Republicans is by raising consciousness and by giving the Republicans an offer that they can't refuse. And that is that if they continue along that approach of wanting to cut Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, education, protecting the interests of the wealthy and powerful, you know what? That represents about 20% of the American people. And let them have those 20%. Our side will have 80%. We can defeat them. But those are the choices that the president and the Democratic leadership have to make. Make a real, clear statement to the American people and demand their participation. So I agree with Neil. I think we have not done that. I'm an independent caucus with the Democrats. But when the president talks about cutting Social Security, and benefits for disabled vets, he muddies the message. He muddies the message and makes it hard for the average person to say, well, is there really much of a difference between the Republicans and Democrats?
Lawrence in Berkeley, California, listening on the WCPT stream.
Hi, Bernie. I wanted to ask you, Bernie, in my reading of the Constitution, Congress can overturn Citizens United without a constitutional amendment because Article 3, Section 2 says the Supreme Court shall have jurisdiction with such exceptions and under such regulations as the Congress shall make. So therefore, Congress only has to say, by majority vote, you may not rule on what constitutes a human being.
Lawrence, I have to respectfully disagree with you. I think it's more complicated than that. Congress, of course, can start the process for a constitutional amendment and then bring it to the states. But I think most lawyers would not agree with your interpretation. By a 5-4 vote, the Supreme Court decided on that Citizens United decision that a corporation is a person and has the political right to spend as much money as they want during a political campaign. I think it's a decision that very few Americans agree with. I think we've got to overturn it. But I would say, Lawrence, your way politically would not work. We don't have the support to do it in the Congress. And I think that that's probably not a proper approach.
26 minutes past the hour, or 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program. Our Brunch with Bernie, our Senator Bernie Sanders, answering your questions, taking your calls in our national town hall meeting here, Brunch with Bernie.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And be sure to check out Bernie's website at sanders.senate.gov. You can subscribe to the Bernie Buzz. You can sign his petitions. And it's a great news site in general, sanders.senate.gov. 34 minutes past the hour. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program, occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. And this hour is Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls in our national town hall meeting. Mike in Clarksville, Tennessee, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you, Senator Sanders, for your honest service to this great nation.
Thank you.
I just wanted to briefly touch on the federal budget deficit debate. You know, I think what we all need to do is get back to fundamental economics, which is mainly just numbers. You know, the American people may be confused about a lot of other stuff, but, you know, we know how numbers add up and don't. You know, the federal budget deficit, that's about a trillion and a half a year, and most of that money goes directly into the top 1% income earners. You know, that's the reason that we have a budget deficit is because, you know, supply and demand have to equal out. Otherwise, we'd have no economy whatsoever. And, you know, instead of raising people's wages like we should have been all this time these last 30 years, we've just been encouraging people to take out more debt on their own, and the government's been spending, you know, government spending, which is just debt. And, of course, you know, that of course that goes into everybody's pocket who benefits from that.
So, but Mike, do you have a question for Bernie?
Well, I think I got Mike's.
Okay, you got the sense.
Let me just a couple of points, okay. Mike. The deficit is, in fact, a serious issue, but it is not the most serious issue. The most serious issue is that real unemployment in this country is almost 14%, that it is a lot higher for younger people, for minorities, and that we have got to put people back to work. And by the way, when you put people back to work, when your economy expands, people then are not getting unemployment, they're not getting welfare, they're not getting food stamps. What they are doing is paying taxes. When you create jobs, you help lower the deficit as well. And I believe that one of the things that we can do, which will stimulate the economy, put people back to work, is rebuild our crumbling infrastructure, roads, bridges, rail, water systems, put a lot of people back to work doing that, and also start transforming our energy system away from fossil fuel to energy efficiency and sustainable energy. The deficit today, by the way, is not $1.5 trillion. We have made some significant progress in recent years. I believe it's lower than $900 billion right now. That's still a lot of money. But the issue that we have to deal with, I'm not sure that everybody understands it, is what our Republican friends want to do is say, okay, we've got a deficit. The only way that we will consider to deal with the deficit is to cut. Cut unemployment benefits. Cut nutrition programs. Cut educational opportunities. Cut Medicare. Cut Medicaid. And when you do that, not only do you cause a whole lot of suffering for working families and low-income people who are struggling to keep their heads above water, you lose jobs. If you're cutting education, that means instead of hiring preschool educators, you are laying them off. If you're cutting back on public services, if first responders, fire departments, police departments, you're laying off police officers and firemen rather than hiring more of them. So you're growing unemployment. You're increasing unemployment rather than lowering it. So I think the solution to deficit reduction is you need more revenue. Right now, revenue is about 16% of GDP, very, very low compared to modern American history. So I think Mike's point is that federal investments create jobs. And one of the reasons that people are in a lot of trouble is that when wages go down, and when you have a middle class disappearing, when real wages go down, when people are now working longer hours for low wages, how do they make up the difference? They have to borrow money. They go deeper in debt. So, I think Mike makes a good point, but the bottom line is the most important issue the government has got to deal with now is creating jobs.
Paul in San Francisco, California. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello, Senator Sanders. I'm calling about the Postal Service, and I know that you have put forward a bill to help save them, and I believe Representative DeFazio is working on the House side.
Yes.
Can you tell us what is happening with those two bills and
Good question.
What we, a regular person like me can do to help move those along and maybe...
All right, let me back up a little bit and tell the listeners what the issue is and talk a bit about what people can do. A couple of years ago, the Postmaster General came up with the idea that we should shut down 15,000 rural post offices in America, shut them down completely, regardless of what that means to rural communities, shut down about half of the processing plants in America, slow down mail delivery and Saturday mail service, and shrink the size, the number of workers that we have in the Postal Service by several hundred thousand, all of which takes place in the middle of a recession where unemployment is much too high. I and a number of other senators and members of the House disagree with that approach. And we think that, and it's not what we think, but the fact is, and most people don't know this, is the major financial problem facing the Postal Service is not the decline in first-class mail, which is a serious issue. Obviously, people use email now who used to use first-class mail. That is an issue. But the most serious problem is that in 2006, Congress mandated for the Postal Service something that no other government agency comes close to have to doing, and in fact, no private company does, and that is to pay out 75 years of retiree health benefits in a 10-year period. And that means that the Postal Service has to put over $5 billion every single year into that retiree health program, which is, as I recall, about 85% of the financial problems facing the Postal Service. So they have some other problems. That is the main problem. And if you address that problem, you've gone a long way to solving the financial problems facing the Postal Service today. And obviously, our legislation does that. Second area is that the Postal Service, in a very aggressive way, has got to address the fact that we do live in the 21st century and that email is real and computers are real and make changes accordingly to respond to that. And thirdly, they have got to be more aggressive in developing new ways to raise revenue. Right now, by law, if you walk into a postal service and you say something as simple as, can you please notarize this document before I mail it, they can't do it by law, if you can believe that. They can't give you 10 copies of a document that you have. They don't have, they're not allowed to reproduce those documents. They can't sell you a fishing license or a hunting license by law. So if we ease those regulations, we allow them to become a little bit more entrepreneurial, and raise more revenue, I think we can go a long way to solving their financial problems, maintaining a decent level of employment in the postal service, and keeping services alive in rural areas like the state of Vermont, where it is very, very important for folks. Now, what can people do? Well, we have good support. Can't remember the exact number of co-sponsors, but we have a lot. I think a lot of senators, some conservative ones, understand how important the postal service is to the elderly, to veterans, and to other people. So I would urge, Paul, get the word out. I'm sorry I don't have the number of the bill in front of me, but it's the Sanders bill on postal reform, and we would appreciate people making calls to their senators and House members in support of that.
And callcongress.org is a website on one of our websites that has the phone numbers for the switchboards and even some toll-free numbers that you can use to call Congress, to call your members of Congress. Bob, in Woodbury Heights, New Jersey, you're on the air, Senator Sanders.
Hi, Senator Sanders. Hi, Tom. Pleasure. I'm a postal worker at a processing plant and an officer in the union. I won't tell you what I do. They never about know who I am. But I would like to know how you feel about Senator Carper and Representative Cummings, who sit on the committees for government oversight. And when I watch them on C-SPAN, they seem a little squishy. Yeah. You have confidence in them, or what's your feelings on them?
Well, let me just, without commenting on individual members of Congress, let me just say this. I got involved. I'm not on the committee in the Senate. That goes through the Homeland Security Committee, which has jurisdiction for a number of government programs, including the Postal Service. So I don't sit on that committee, which is chaired by Senator Carper. And Elijah Cummings is the ranking member, Democrat, in the House. What I observed a couple of years ago, when Joe Lieberman was the chair of that committee, I was not happy with the direction in which the committee was moving. I thought it was making kinds of cuts in the Postal Service that I felt uncomfortable with. So what my role was, I organized kind of an ad hoc committee, which I think ended up being 15 or 16 members of the Senate, who shared my concern. The end result of that is we were able to make the bill that got to the floor a lot stronger than what had originally been in the Homeland Security Committee. It was a reasonable bill, and it passed the Senate with, I think, 62-63 votes. Didn't do everything that my legislation did, but it did address this most important issue of ending the onerous burden of $5.5 billion every year going into this retiree health plan. So we are now working with Carper and the committee to get the strongest bill that we can. I think we may end up seeing something close to the bill that passed the Senate last year.
That didn't make it through the House, though, right?
That's correct.
Yeah, okay. Senator Bernie Sanders with us, 45 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with more Brunch with Bernie right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And visit Bernie's website at sanders.senate.gov, a great news site. Plus, you can sign up for his newsletter. Welcome back to the place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say no. Not a chance. The Tom Hartman Program. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. Bernie, you were just talking about wealth and corporate power. May I, with your permission, read three sentences from Thomas Jefferson that maybe you can riff on?
Sure.
Okay. He was speaking of what happens if super wealthy people get too much power, too much political power. Keep in mind that the wealthiest man who signed the Declaration of Independence, John Hancock, was only worth $700,000 in today's money. These guys were the upper middle class. They were not the real rich. Those people all left. Anyhow, Jefferson said, "Those seeking profits, were they given total freedom, would not be the ones to trust to keep government pure and our rights secure. Indeed, it has always been those seeking wealth who were the source of corruption in government. No other depositories of power have ever yet been found which did not end in converting to their own profit the earnings of those committed to their charge. If the overgrown wealth of an individual be deemed dangerous to the state, the best corrective is the law of equal inheritance to all in equal degree." He's talking about an estate tax, essentially.
Well, look, I mean, I think what Jefferson wrote then is true today in spades. the kind of inequality we have. And just, you know, Tom, it's very interesting to me. There was a poll that came out. Gallup did a poll, I think, a week or two ago. And I don't have the exact wording in front of me, but basically they asked the American people, they said, how do you feel about distribution of wealth in America? And over 60% said, we worry about it. It's unfair. And then they asked this question, and this is what the question was. Do you believe the government should redistribute wealth by raising taxes significantly on the rich? And I don't have the exact statement in front of me, so I may be off by a word or two, but that's essentially what it said. You know what? 52% of the people said yes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do you know how many people in the United States Congress would even raise that issue? A handful.
Yeah.
So you have the majority of the people picking up what on Lee's point. They understand there is something wrong when so few have so much. When the top 1% owns 38% of the wealth in America and the bottom 60% owns 2.3%, and when these guys, the Koch brothers and others, make greed into their religion, and they say, that's not enough. We only have $50 billion in our family. What do we care that over 20% of the kids in America live in poverty? What do we care that people listening to this show right this minute, seniors, don't have enough money to buy the food they need? That's not our problem. We need more and more and more. Cut our taxes. Cut programs for working people. And then they come up with a whole philosophical and economic treatise that they pay professors to write why it is always a great idea to give more to the rich and more to the powerful and take from the working people and the poor. And, you know, they have all these organizations that come up with these great theories. But that's what it amounts to, what Jefferson was writing about and what Lee is talking about. Now, how do we deal with that? The answer is, and every week people ask that same question, and the answer is not complicated. It is old-fashioned political organizing. That means people have got to understand that it is terribly important for the future of this nation, for the salvation of the middle class of this country, that they be involved in the political process. What does that mean? It means not just registering to vote. It means holding your elected officials accountable, holding town meetings, organizing petitions. Politicians do the wrong thing when nobody is holding them accountable. And right now, for example, I've been working very hard with a number of other senators on trying to prevent cuts to Social Security. I think we got a shot to winning. You know why we have a shot to win? Because we're waking up the American people. And the American people overwhelmingly do not believe that you maintain huge loopholes for large corporations and then cut Social Security or Medicaid, etc. And when people stand up and say, excuse me, Mr. Senator, or Ms. Congresswoman, you ain't going to do that, guess what? They won't do it. But if people are not paying attention, that's when bad things happen, because the lobbyists are all over Washington, D.C. People are getting huge amounts of campaign contributions to do the wrong things. And the only antidote to that is people by the millions saying, excuse me, we ain't going to do that.
Okay. David, watching or listening over at sanders.senate.gov in Mamaroneck, New York, you're on the air with Senator Sanders. We have just 2 minutes to the end of the show, so real quick question, please.
Oh, hi. Good afternoon, Mr. Sanders. I'll make this really quick. You know, I never dreamed in my life that what I was learning in school, and it was faintly the muckrakers and the trust breaking at the early of the last century, would ever repeat itself in the United States. But I think you would agree with me that that's what's been happening since the Ronald Reagan. Do you think it's going to take a depression to get us out? Are we going to have a Calvin Coolidge who, did, as you know, didn't turn his back on the Great Mississippi Flood before things change?
Well, David, I don't want to see a mass depression and suffering. And also, I think, by the way, looking at Germany in the 1930s, when people become very, very, very desperate and don't have enough to eat and the money is worthless, they look at demagogues for solution. So I hope we don't need, I certainly hope that doesn't happen. I think, as I just mentioned a moment ago, David, we just need grassroots organizing, and I know that is really hard. It really is hard stuff. It is hard to elect strong progressives. It is hard to make sure that we keep people accountable. It is hard to even learn the information about the information that we need, because the media very often will talk about superficial things and not basic things. We don't hear a whole lot of discussion about income and wealth inequality in the media and how we can deal with that. So, David, no, I certainly don't want to see a depression. We've got, as I said earlier, we've got almost 14% unemployment today. That's quite high enough for me, and I want to see that cut. But I think we just do it by working with our neighbors, electing good people, holding them accountable, demanding that they stand up for working families and not the wealthy and the powerful.
Bernie, just 15 seconds, quick final thought.
Well, the final thought is that we are heading into some very, very difficult moments. Congress is going to have to make some real choices. And I hope the American people stand firm, let their members of Congress know no cuts to Social Security, no raising premiums on Medicare, no cuts to Medicaid, that we have to ask the wealthiest people in this country and the largest corporations to help us deal with deficit reduction. And we can't do that. We can't balance the budget on the backs of people who are already hurting.
So very, very well said. Senator Bernie Sanders, sanders.senate.gov is the website. Bernie, thank you again for being with us.
All right, my pleasure, Tom. Thank you.
Always an honor. We will be back. It's Anything Goes Friday. Your calls on whatever topic you'd like. I've got a few news stories and rants to share with you, too, as we continue on through the program. We'll be right back. It is just a couple minutes before the top of the hour.
Listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, 10 students, 74 teachers cut from Head Start in just Wichita, Kansas. Why is that of consequence? Because Congressman Mike Pompeo, is that how it's pronounced? P-O-M-P-E-O? Pompeo, maybe? Tweeted, America did fine. We can survive the spending cuts. Right. Except that $750,000 has been cut from the federal courthouse in Kansas. Public defenders and prosecutors are being laid off. The FAA did, you know, the Congress did restore the money to the FAA because the flights were slowing down and members of Congress want to get back home to their districts. But they've done nothing for the rest of this. He calls this a home run for America. Meanwhile, Paul Ryan is saying, oh, it's all the president's fault. It was his idea. When Paul Ryan actually wrote the legislation, the sequestration legislation, or helped write it. It's really, you know, this whole thing is turning into a freak show. And it's one where these guys are going, they're doing absolutely everything they can to make our economy stink. I mean, you know, you've got 14 to 17 million people unemployed in the United States right now who would like to work. And 10 million officially looking for work right now. And the Republicans love this. You know, let's have, you know, weak economy. I mean, they, you know, it's like they did the same thing to Jimmy Carter. And just, you know, make the economy, cut back on government spending. And then Ronald Reagan comes into office and all of a sudden government spending just exploded. And instead of financing it with taxes, like normally you do, we cut taxes on rich people. He doubled taxes on working people making less than $40,000 a year. But that wasn't, you know, that didn't produce anywhere near enough money. So Reagan ran up almost a $3 trillion deficit. When he came into office, the entire national debt of the United States was only $800 billion. Here we are, 33 years of Reaganomics later. And can't we say finally that, you know, sorry, it's a failed experiment? Austerity. I mean, look what austerity is doing to Greece and Spain. They have higher unemployment rate numbers right now than we did during the Great Depression, during the worst years of the Great Depression. And the result of that is the rise of a neo-Nazi party in Greece and a communist party in Spain. It's like when, you know, when people are desperate, when people are freaked out, they go to the extremes. Or they'll go to, you know, whatever demagogue offers them a complete solution. Meanwhile, a court order some months back said, or maybe it was more than a year ago, actually, that said that Plan B, which is a contraceptive, it's just basically a high-dose contraception, you know, oral hormone contraceptive pill that prevents a fertilized egg or an egg that has met a sperm in the fallopian tubes from implanting into the uterus. That process takes 2 to 3 days. It prevents it from implanting, so it prevents it a pregnancy from ever actually happening. If you're defining a pregnancy as the point at which the fertilized egg attaches itself to the inside of the uterus and begins to establish a placenta and to grow and like that. So it prevents that from happening, and that fertilized egg gets passed out, as do many fertilized eggs. About 40% of them, as far as anybody can tell, just with a normal menstrual period. So this is how Plan B works, and the court said it should be available. This is a safe drug, particularly when compared to the side effects of pregnancy, which can be medically a very serious condition, particularly for a very young woman. And so the court said Plan B should be available to anybody, any woman of any age, over the counter, without a prescription, without having to, you know, go beg and plead or ask anybody or confide to anybody or whatever, whether, you know, rape, incest, or just plain old sex, whatever it may be. If a teenager or somebody of any age is concerned that they might have, you know, had sex in a way that could cause them to become pregnant, they should be able to have Plan B available. The Obama administration has limited that to the age of 15 and above. They actually lowered it from 18 to 15. I'm of the opinion that it should be lower than that, personally, because I think that if you consider the dangers of pregnancy, it is more dangerous for a 12-year-old or a 13-year-old or a 14-year-old to be pregnant than it is for a 15 or 16 or 17-year-old to be pregnant. I mean, they are not yet fully mature or even close to it. And so if you are going to prevent the pregnancy from happening in the first place, this is contraception, then I disagree with the Obama administration on this, you know, 15-year-old rule, and I agree with the court. And the Obama and the administration right now is at odds with the court. We're going to see how this plays out. Meanwhile, Fox News is freaking out, saying that if teenagers have sex, that's criminal behavior, and they should the girl should be forced to have the baby and the boy should go to jail, I guess. I actually think that if both parties are underage, it's not illegal in most states. And in fact, that's, you know, how it's being laid out in over at the Center for American Progress's blog. But in any case, just, you know, for what it's worth, some of the things in the news that I'm noticing that I think are of consequence. And then finally, nullification. Mississippi tried to nullify federal laws back in January. Kansas tried to do it last year. Now Alabama, earlier this week, Alabama passed a law that said that any federal gun control laws don't apply in Alabama. So apparently in Alabama, if you want to call a shoulder-fired rocket launcher or surface-to-air missile launcher a gun or a fully automatic machine gun, a gun, then in Alabama, they're going to ignore the federal laws. That's a violation of the Constitution. The Constitution has this thing called the Supremacy Clause, which basically says that federal laws are the supreme law of the land. And you know, I mean, I'm not a constitutional lawyer, and I can tell you that. You can read it right there in the Constitution. And we have three states now that have voted to nullify laws: Mississippi, Kansas, and Alabama. James Madison, the author of the Constitution, the father of the Constitution, not the author, the father of the Constitution, said that nullification of federal law would, quote, speedily put an end to the Union itself. Nullification is essentially what the southern states were doing as we, you know, when they decided that they were no longer going to be governed by the laws of the northern states in 1860. And leading up to the election of President Lincoln, there were several of these states that said, okay, that's it. You know, there had been attempts at nullification. Nullification laws had been passed. And ultimately, they started seceding from the Union. And by the time Lincoln was sworn into office, he had a full-blown rebellion on his hands, and pretty soon we had a civil war. We litigated this. And 600,000, if my memory is correct, Americans died. The bloodiest war, in, you know, on a per capita basis relative to our overall population in the history of America, the bloodiest war on the North American continent once we were America. Now, I would argue that we had two previous Holocausts, one being the Holocaust of African Americans being held in slavery and being murdered routinely, and the other being the Holocaust of Native Americans. But to this point, to the point of nullification, we've already settled this, guys.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
But it's Anything Goes Friday, so we'll pick up your calls after this, 15 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. Talk media for the sane among us. Tom Hartman here helping you win the water cooler wars. Jason in Arlington, Virginia. Jason, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
I'm good.
I was real interested in what Bernie was talking about with the large banks and so forth. And one of the things I know specifically about them is the large banks have increased their derivative exposure by over 43% since the financial crisis began. So whatever was too big to fail before is even bigger. I believe that the nominal amount right now is close to $293 trillion worth of derivatives.
That the U.S. banks are holding. I mean, the New York Times reported earlier this week that the global trade in derivatives was $700 trillion.
Right. So that's our share of it. You know, if you throw in the rest of the world, it could be even worse, the HSBCs and so forth.
Sure.
But I think, you know, the best way to solve this is really simple. And this is my libertarian solution. Why don't we just put a thing on the door of every bank, just like it has to say FDIC, that says every quarter or every month you have to put on the amount of derivative exposures that your bank has. And just like labeling food, you could say, well, I don't know if I want to keep my money in that bank.
Yeah, that's not very libertarian. The libertarians would say, you know, the corporation gets to hide that stuff.
No. Well, they don't.
You can't have a government regulation that says that you have to be transparent.
It's about fraud, hiding things from clients. You're not going to have to, you know, it's like food labeling, like GMOs.
Right. Yeah, libertarians are opposed to food labeling.
No. They're depends on what, you know, branch you're looking at.
Okay.
But this is a very
okay. So you're in the I like government enforcing transparency branch of libertarianism.
No, I'm ensuring that the individuals out there know what's in their product. Just like if you go buy a piece of food, if it says milk on it, it should be milk. Just like if I get water out of the tap, I want to know.
I don't think that's libertarian. I think that's just like a, you know, good policy.
Well, so let's take this and run with it. Real simple.
Yeah.
All you do is you put that on the bank thing, and then consumers can make their own decision. But if Congress wanted to do it in a simple way, what they could say is, why don't we just get rid of any FDIC insurance on any bank that engages in this? Now, a bank can continue to do that if they want to. But
why don't we just say that if you're going to trade in derivatives, they have to be on a regulated exchange? I mean, that would do away with all of this. Just roll back the Phil Graham's Commodities Futures Modernization Act. Just undo it.
Well, that would be an option, but I think the easiest way would be just allowing people to decide for themselves.
Okay. Well, if you did it, then I would suggest that there be a divisor there.
On the hook. But even if it was traded on the exchange, Tom, the fact that you're giving these big banks FDIC insurance is the problem. It's the moral hazard that these guys are like, well, it doesn't really matter. We're going to get bailed out.
FDIC insurance is for the depositors, not for the banks, and it only covers the first quarter million. And, you know, there's a lot more. I mean, there are many people who have a lot more money than that in banks, particularly big companies and corporations that are not covered by that. So there's you know, I would, you know, I don't disagree with you, Jason. In fact, I would take it a step farther and I would say, take that derivative exposure, divide it by the total amount of actual deposits, money on deposit, and actually subtract from it the amount of money on deposit. So let's say that they've got $50 billion in exposure and they've got, or $50 trillion in exposure and they have $50 billion in deposits. And so you'd say, for every dollar that you put in this bank owes $1,000.
There are many ways about this. I just think the hard part about in this situation is this. In the last 4 years, anything that's been done to try to stop a systematic catastrophic failure from happening again, despite all of these crazy things, they're still allowing it to go on.
You're right. You're right. And it is happening right across the board. There are a number of Democrats who are fighting the good fight, and it's nice to see Neil Barofsky trying to do what he can with the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. But his hands are tied by Congress. And I'd like to see the president step up and shout about this some more. And, I'm with you, Jason. Thanks a lot for the call. Arthur in Excel, Alabama. Hey, Arthur, what's up?
Hi. I'm in the process. You had mentioned that Alabama is not going to follow the federal gun laws. Well, the reason I called was that's not the only thing that's going on down there.
Okay.
I actually have property in two different counties there, and New York, because they figured out Alabama has got the most lax EPA laws in the country, they actually bought 800,000 acres of land down there so they can build a dump to take the toxic stuff from New York and bring it down there and dump it.
Oh,
yeah, I just told my brother yesterday that I'm glad you brought this topic up because there's about 15 agencies I'm going to call once I get moved out of there. They are, all kinds of federal laws. They don't enforce them down there. Hmm. And when I asked about it when I first moved down there, they said, well, you can't enforce the law if there's no one to enforce it, right?
Right. Right. And that's the thing. I mean, there's agency after agency after agency at the federal level is understaffed or unstaffed. I mean, even right now, this is a problem for John Kerry as Secretary of State. He's got no Undersecretary of State because the Senate won't confirm it. I mean, he's got entire divisions, entire departments that work with him and answer to him that Republicans in Congress are refusing to fund. You know, the sequester is cutting into the office of the Secretary of State as well. It's absolutely insane. These Republicans, they're doing everything they can to destroy the government so that they can then stand around and say, see, the government's broken. Let's just turn it all over to the Koch brothers. Let's let the big corporations just run everything. No regulations. Just let them do it.
I actually seen an ambulance show up with two babies were turning blue, and they looked at the mother and they said, that's $700 in advance before we'll take your babies to the hospital.
Are you kidding?
The catalytic law that we've had on the books since, 1975, you can't take a catalytic converter off a car unless you put another one back on.
Right.
They're still chopping them off and putting straight pipes in. You can burn tires in your backyard, and everybody, it's illegal, but everybody looks the other way. No one cares. Trash burning. I have another piece of property in a little town called Flat Rock. They don't even have trash pickup there. You ask them what to do with your glass bottles and plastic, and they say, well, everybody burns it around here.
Yeah, yeah, amazing. Or digs a hole in the ground. Arthur, thanks a lot for the call. Sorry to hear about your situation there in Alabama. And, but we need good people all over the country. So please fight the good fight. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Maybe we should call it Cocobama. You know, it's becoming the libertarian paradise of Charles and David Koch. Cocobama. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Defending America from the weapons of mass deception. And boy, there's a lot of them out there, aren't there? Peggy in Waukesha, Wisconsin, or Waukesha, Wisconsin. Am I saying Waukesha?
Yeah, Waukesha.
Waukesha, Wisconsin. Thank you, Peggy.
Yeah.
What's up?
Yeah. Well, when you talk about the number of people's lives that were wrecked by the Iraq and our wars, our George Bush wars,
right.
Could we add to that list the guys that come home from those wars and commit crimes? Because sometimes the PTSD gets out of hand,
mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if our courts and juries really know what to do with these guys.
Well, this speaks to the larger issue of the fact that our criminal justice system is not built around or geared toward rehabilitation or therapy. It's just built around and geared toward punishment. And it's getting even worse as we turn to private prisons, where they're cutting back even more on rehabilitative services and in, you know, basically just putting people in cages. And so if somebody comes back from Iraq or Afghanistan and they've been taught how to kill, something that is, you know, just fundamentally we are born recoiling at the idea, and yet we've been taught to kill. They may have killed or seen killing. They may have been wounded or injured. They emotionally, physically, psychologically, and then they come back to the United States and they commit a crime, in part as a consequence of that injury. I mean, we see this now with Vietnam vets. We can look back retrospectively. The highest proportion of people among the homeless are the Vietnam vets. I mean, I'm not sure that they're the highest, but they're massively overrepresented relative to the population.
Here's my idea.
Go ahead.
We take their criminal justice system and put it into the VA or put it into another justice system for those guys?
Well, what about somebody who was born in a ghetto in a very, very poor area and saw people killed in gang warfare out in front of their house and grew up, you know, in a gang environment, and by the time they're 12 or 13 or 14, they're as damaged as somebody who went off to war and came back from war? Shouldn't we fundamentally reform our entire criminal justice system?
Yeah, we should. There's a guy in our community that committed a very bad crime, and I'm thinking the jury is not going to know what to do with him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, there are, you know, insanity and defenses, and before the private prison industry started lobbying, judges used to have and juries used to have a fair amount of latitude in sentencing. Now, increasingly, we have minimum mandatory sentences, which guarantee a certain level of profitability to the private for-profit prisons, which is why we have the highest rate of incarceration in the world. And but an interesting point, Peggy. Thanks for calling and sharing it. Very interesting, very, very thought-provoking. Bob in Clifton, Tennessee, listening on Sirius. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Hello, Tom. I just recently finished your book, Threshold, which I highly recommend to people.
Thank you.
And I was taken by something on page 85, beginning on page 85, where you discuss Schlein, Ong, and Logan, speaking about early reading instruction, kind of solidifying the left brain attitudes.
That's correct. And just for people who don't know what you're talking about my references to Leonard Schlein, who wrote a book called The Alphabet Versus the Goddess, which is absolutely brilliant. Len Schlein, I used to know him. He passed away a year or so ago. He was a brain surgeon. And then I think it was Walter Ong, and I forget Logan's first name, Robert Logan. And they wrote a book called one of them wrote a book called Oralcy Versus Literacy or And Literacy. And the other wrote another book, and they were all about basically the differences between cultures and societies where people are literate and societies that where people are not literate, where they pass down information by story, you know, the oral tradition stories, societies, and the differences between those who are literate using highly abstract alphabets like we do, where a letter can just have a sound, it doesn't have a meaning, versus those that use pictographs, where you look at the pictures and you know what is being talked about in the writing. These are processed in different ways in different parts of the brain, and when they are learned prior to the age of 7, they cause actual permanent physical changes in the brain. So end of my riff. Where did you want to go with that?
Well, you also mentioned Rudolf Steiner.
Yeah.
Recommending no reading before 7 years of age. And I read a book called Passages About Earth back in the early 70s by William Irwin Thompson. And he spoke about Homo Ludens, the play, and Homo Faber. And he also recommended play being the first 7 years. And so my question is, President Obama's budget proposes universal preschool.
Yeah.
And it seems to me to be very important what is to be, quote, taught, what activities will be participated in by the children if we have universal preschool. I would suggest play, Montessori material, sand, water, blocks, and such, and to be read to rather than learning to read.
Yes, I agree. I absolutely agree. And in fact, in Sweden, they don't actually start formally teaching you how to read and write until you're 7 years old. And you graduate from high school at the age of 16, and they have a higher literacy rate, a higher high school graduation rate, a higher, going on to college rate in Sweden than we do here. And Sweden used to be the scourge of Europe. They used to be one of the most violent countries in Europe, and they're now, world famous for their pacifism. I think that there's a relationship between the two. And if I was, if I was a king or even president, I would be suggesting that our early education programs should be about art, should be about music. We should be reading to our kids. We should be teaching. We should be telling them stories. We should be teaching them our social values and standards through stories. I mean, everybody's familiar with, for example, with the story of the little boy who cried wolf, or the little boy who said that the king had no clothing on. What most people don't realize is that these are the ways that we transmit our cultural values from generation to generation. And none of that requires reading. All of that, but all of that does require interaction with children. The other thing that I'm not sure is in my book Threshold that I've seen it several times. I just saw it recently. There was just another study published in one of the journals that was reprinted in one of the science sites that I read, that the average child of poverty in the United States by the age of 5 or 6 or 7, it was somewhere early in there, has been exposed to a certain number of words, and my recollection is that the number was, I don't want to try to remember the exact number, but they had been exposed to a certain number of words, whereas the average middle class or upper class child economically had been exposed to dramatically more words, let's say 20 or 30% more words. And as a consequence, after that second great demyelination that happens around the age of 7, the ability to use language in ways that are functional, whether it's functional in relationships or functional in the workplace or, functional, whatever, the ability to use language, the ability to think abstractly, the ability to apply language to problems, the ability to use language to construct both kinesthetic and visual things in the brain is all diminished by that lack of exposure to a large number of words. And so this, I think, is the primary benefit that comes from preschool, because we can see these measurable benefits. The downside of preschool, where we're teaching literacy, is that you're producing a bunch of, right-handed, basically left-brained kids who are, not that right-handedness is a total demonstration of left-brain dominance, where they are all head and no heart, or more head than heart. And if you don't teach children to read abstract languages before the age of 7, you have a balance of head and heart. And these are really important cultural concepts. Am I summarizing this well, Bob?
They also have less ability to express themselves.
Yes.
Which handicaps them in society when they have less vocabulary.
Yes, absolutely. And it's not just because they have less vocabulary. It's because the more words they're exposed to prior to the time when the brain, around the age of 7, a whole chunk of the brain just gets washed away, demyelinated, it gets flushed out in the urine and dissolved in the bloodstream and flushed out by the kidneys. And that when the kids who are exposed to the larger vocabulary end up with a larger area in Broca's region in the left parietal lobe, and the left side of the brain, over by the left ear. And kids who are exposed to a lot of music before the age of 7 have a larger Wernicke's region, the right parietal lobe. And those are both good things, particularly if they're in balance. And that's why I was saying, music, and I would have music education as a very, very important part of that preschool stuff in our early education. I think we need to revisit the whole thing, and I think that Maria Montessori and Rudolf Steiner were so right on so many things. And if you haven't read The Alphabet Versus the Goddess, it's a really good book. I also, and as you point out, this is all in my book Threshold, or some of it, I reference it. It's also in my book The Edison Gene, which is one of the premiums that we're giving away on Free Speech TV right now. Bob, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for reading my book and for the kind words about it. We'll be back 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Anything Goes Friday. Your calls, you pick the topic. I mean, we can talk about neuroscience, or we can talk about... one of the things I want to talk about is this increasing suicide rate. It's getting scary. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service to find out what's going on in the world. The Talk Radio News brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. Where you can get a beautiful crystal pendant, a heart-shaped pendant that is, they're great gifts. We bought a bunch of them to give as gifts. And they're made in South Sudan by women who have witnessed people killed in front of them as part of a therapy program that Ellen Ratner helped put together. It's all over at goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Ellen.
And it's a good Mother's Day gift.
It is.
Okay, so just some quick news, because I know everybody likes to follow this. Not that it shouldn't be followed, but the body of the first suspect in the marathon bombing is at a funeral home. A funeral director got a lot of grief for it, but apparently he has helped drug addicts. He's helped, you know, homeless people who had no place to have a funeral do it. So this is not uncommon. The wife gave up her claims to it. The DNA is not a match to the wife. There's also going to be a Boston Strong concert May 30th that includes Aerosmith and James Taylor. And the governor, Deval Patrick, said that July 4th is going to be safe. On the economy, which is really the big news today, 165 jobs created in April.
165,000.
What?
165,000.
Yeah, did I not say 165,000? Yes. Sorry. More than expected, and they revised the figure up for February and March as well. It's the 38th straight month that the private sector has created jobs. 7.5 unemployment, lowest rate in 5 years. They still say, and this is something you've been talking about, that it's a slow, soft economic recovery. Alan Krueger, he is from the Council on Economic Advisers. He said this is not a time to do self-inflicted wounds such as the sequestration. And the market briefly broke 15,000 today.
Right. The rich are getting richer. The market's doing great. The working class and the middle class are doing worse. And really, the reason why the economy is so soft is because we've laid off 800,000 government workers, mostly in the states around the country, and now the sequestration is starting to lay off federal workers.
Right. Yeah. And it's got, I mean, the Council on Economic Advisers, Alan Krueger, is right that it is self-inflicted wounds.
Yeah.
Okay, president is in Mexico. He spoke to younger people. He focused on economic growth and trade, not on immigration or the drug war. Mexico's economy is growing, and it's faster even than Brazil. He also said it is a time to banish stereotypes.
What does that mean?
That, you know, of the Mexican that is just trying to be part of a drug cartel or trying to escape the border. He says that it's an economy. And,
but, I mean, he's in Mexico, and he's saying banish stereotypes. Was he talking about Americans need to stop thinking of Hispanics?
Americans needing to banish the stereotypes.
Okay, so he wasn't talking about Mexicans thinking of Americans as ugly Americans or something like
that.
Clear. Okay.
Okay. Clarence Thomas, apparently he had an interview with C-SPAN. It's just now sort of making its way out. He said that a black president is possible, but if it's only approved by the elites and the media.
Right. Yeah, I read that.
Okay. And the NRA has had their convention now. There's a new president, Jim Porter. He's been known for pretty extreme views. He called the Civil War a war of northern aggression. He said Obama wants European-styled socialism. He said they are fighting a culture war that goes beyond gun rights. This is the NRA he's talking about. The theme of the NRA conference this year is Stand Up and Fight.
Wow. This at the time that 44% of self-identified Republicans think that we may need an armed revolution in the United States.
Right. I mean, but clearly he is reflective if he's the incoming president of this insanity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
It kind of blows my mind on that. one sort of other small thing here. Well, it's not so small. First of all, Congress is coming back into session next week, and there's been, of course, calls for them to pay attention to the economy, to make sure that sequestration doesn't happen in quite the way, and we'll see what happens when they get back. But, you know, they were, like, gone.
Yeah, well, and Paul Ryan had a town hall meeting last night where he said, oh, it's all President Obama's fault. He's you know.
Well, actually, that's exactly what Boehner basically said when the economic numbers came out today. He said, you know, this is not really to be trusted. It should be further growth. It should be this. It should be that. I mean, Boehner is, there is the sort of left view that, of course, this is not an economic recovery for working class, but then there's also the right view that says there's no economic recovery.
Amazing.
Sort of last but not least here, Chuck Schumer, Senator Schumer from New York, he said in an Upstate TV interview yesterday that insurance companies need to be watched. I agree with him on that one. But the rate increases are the result of Obamacare. And that then he backtracked on that, and he said that pre-Obamacare rates were already going up, so it really doesn't have anything to do with Obamacare, because he got
The reality is that Obamacare is going to raise the rates for some small number of people, and those are the ones that the Republicans are going to be all over, you know, over the next 2 years as this stuff goes into effect. And it's reducing the insurance costs for the vast majority of Americans.
Okay. Yeah, so, I agree.
Yeah.
I mean,
so but we'll see how it plays out. I've got the NRA, the War of Northern Aggression. I don't know if you want to hear this guy.
Oh, I'd love
this
to.
This is a hoot. Just listen to this.
It was started 1871 right here in New York State. It was started by some Yankee generals who didn't like the way my Southern boys had the ability to shoot in what we call the War of Northern Aggression. Now, y'all might call it the Civil War, but we call it the War of Northern Aggression down south. But that was the very reason that they started the National Rifle Association, was to teach and train the civilian in the use of the standard military firearm. And I am one who still feel very strongly that that is one of our most greatest charges that we can have.
We got to teach people how to use military weaponry. It's amazing, huh, Ellen?
Staggering.
Yeah, okay. Ellen Ratner, thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
Great talking with you. And check out goatsfortheoldgoat.com. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Suicide. Pretty grim stuff. Welcome back to the third hour of our program. This new report, this is the consequence of Reaganomics. I'll just say this straight up and let all the conservatives who are listening right now let their heads explode. And now I'm going to back it up. The suicide rate among middle-aged Americans climbed 28% in the last 10 years. 28%. It was most pronounced. It jumped 40% among white men and women in that age group. Now, speculation is that the reason why it didn't go up as much, in fact, it went up very little for African-Americans and Hispanics, is that they were already not doing as well economically, and they had better support networks through churches and communities and tight families as a consequence of being generally lower on the socioeconomic ladder. And so there's this kind of middle-age, middle-income bubble that people find themselves in where they don't have a network of friends. They're not part of a church or a group, and then things fall apart economically. White, middle-aged whites, 35 to 64 years old, 40% increase in suicide rate. Overall, 28% increase in suicide rate. People ages 35 to 64 account for 57% of all suicides in the United States. In 2010, this became the 10th leading cause of death. And what's interesting is that given that this is not returning Iraq war veterans, they're kicking up our suicide rate, but this is not returning Iraq and Afghanistan veterans, because, you know, they're not 35 to 64 years old. They tend to be younger people. The West and the South had the highest rates. And one factor may be cultural differences in the willingness to seek help during tough times. It's also harder to find counseling and mental health services in the South and the poor parts of the West. This from a report by Mike Stobe, or Stobe, S-T-O-B-B-E, in Huffington Post. Suicide rate rises among middle-aged in the U.S., according to the CDC. These are statistics from the Centers for Disease Control, the CDC. Now, why would I say this is Reaganomics causing this? Or just, you know, the bad economy, the Bush recession, whatever you want to call it. I think it's Reaganomics. Well, I go back to this piece. I've been talking about this since we started this show 10 years ago. On the 18th of September, 2002, the BBC News World Edition, it's still on their website. You can easily Google it. The headline is "More Suicides Under Conservative Rule," BBC 2002. You can find it. And I'll just share a few sentences out of it. The suicide rate increases under conservative governments, research suggests. Australian scientists found the suicide rate in that country increased significantly when a conservative government was in power, and an analysis of figures in the United Kingdom seems to suggest a similar trend. Now, they were looking at suicide rates from 1901 to 1998. That's virtually an entire century. And then they said, you know, there's things that we need to do to factor out of this. So the researchers took into account periods of drought and World War II because of their economic and psychological effect. Suicide rates were actually higher during periods of drought and lower during World War II, but they factored those out so that they could get good, clean numbers looking at just conservative versus liberal running the government. After adjusting for these factors, writes the BBC, and this is not a bylined piece. This is the BBC writing this. This is not an op-ed. This is a news story. But after adjusting for these factors, the figures clearly showed the highest rates of suicide occurred when both conservative state and federal governments were in power. This is, they're looking at the entire 20th century. Conversely, the lowest rates of suicide occurred when both state and federal governments were both labor. In other words, liberals, Democrats, what we would call Democrats. Middle-aged and older people were most at risk. When the conservatives ruled both state and federal governments, men were 17% more likely to commit suicide than when labor was in power. Women were 40% more likely to kill themselves. The authors argue that conservative rule traditionally implies a less interventionist and more market-oriented policy than labor rule. This may make people feel more detached from society, they added. I mean, they're not really sure exactly why this is. The lead researcher, Professor Richard Taylor at the University of Sydney, told BBC News Online, quote, "We think it may be because material conditions in lower socioeconomic groups may be relatively better under labor because of government programs, and there's a perception of greater hope by these groups under labor. There is a strong relationship between socioeconomic status and suicide," end of quote. The original research was published in the Journal of Epidemiology and Community Health. And then they, in a series of accompanying editorials, Dr. Mary Shaw and colleagues in the University of Bristol say the same patterns were evident in England and Wales between 1901 and 2000. Rates have been lower under labor governments and soared under the last conservative regime, which began in 1979 under Margaret Thatcher. They fell under the more moderate John Major regime, and after a slight rise when Tony Blair came to power have since fallen again. Now, this was, again, 2002, so you had still had Labour in charge. You still had the Democrats, as it were, in charge of the UK. Overall, they say, just think of this number. The figures suggest that 35,000 people would not have died had the Conservatives not been in power between 1901 and 1998. And then they go through and they list every single period and who 1901 to 1905 suicide rate 101. This was during the Balfour Conservative, 1906 to 1910, the Campbell Bannerman liberal. So, and all the way up to 2000 or up to 1998 when the study was concluded, and of course the article was published, as I said, in 2002 by the BBC. More suicides under Conservative rule. Now, that's the UK and Australia during the entire 20th century. We've had Conservative rule in the United States. I mean, you could call Bill Clinton a liberal if you want, but basically our economic policies were, Reaganomics was never repudiated. Bill Clinton did not take us back to Lyndon Johnson or to Franklin Roosevelt. He didn't take us back to the Great Society and the New Deal. In fact, he undid parts of the Great Society by ending welfare as we know it. And I don't mean this as an indictment of Bill Clinton. I think he did probably the best he could do given what he had and what the times were. But basically, the Obama administration and the Clinton administrations have not been New Deal administrations. Reaganomics has been the economic policy of this country ever since 1981. And now we're seeing the rise in suicides. In my opinion, as a consequence of that. I mean, if the BBC can say as a statement of fact that 35,000 people wouldn't have died if Conservatives had never been elected to run the British government, you have to wonder how many people would not have taken their own lives had Bill Casey not cut a deal with the Ayatollah to keep the hostages so that Jimmy Carter would lose the election and Ronald Reagan became president in 1980. You just have to wonder. If we'd never tried this experiment of trickle-down economics, of Reaganomics, of supply-side economics, if we'd never tried that experiment, if we had stuck with what worked.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Or another way to put it would be, how many people have the Conservatives killed? More heads are exploding. We'll be back. Welcome back. Fair and only slightly unbalanced. Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Anything Goes Friday, and Michael in Imperial Beach, California, watching us on the DirecTV satellite TV system on Free Speech TV. You wanted to talk about Native Americans and in the internal combustion engine?
You got it, Mr. Hartman. How you doing? First off, happy almost birthday.
Thank you.
Well, it seems like if oil is the major problem of our planet, what do you think the Native Americans first thought when they saw the horse for the first time? And second, once they had domesticated the horse, do you think they ever would have wanted or needed to invent the internal combustion engine?
I don't know. I think have you ever read the writings of Daniel Quinn?
I haven't.
Okay. Let me recommend, Michael, if you're rolling around these kinds of questions in your mind, Ishmael and My Ishmael by Daniel Quinn. And that's the order in which you should read them, or just Ishmael is enough. Just My Ishmael is kind of it's a sequel, where he gets into a little more detail, but Ishmael is enough. By Daniel Quinn. Daniel Quinn has been a guest on this program several times. It's been several years though since he was on. And basically his thesis is that, the story device of Ishmael, it's a novel and it's about this fellow sees this ad in the paper that says, do you want to save the world? Show up at this place. And he shows up and there's a gorilla there and they can communicate telepathically with him. And he has this, multi-month conversation with this gorilla who teaches him the history of humanity. And it's a fascinating device. It won a, a prize. I think it was a $250,000 award that Ted Turner had put out for their best fiction of the year back in the 90s. And but all of that aside, basically Daniel Quinn's premise is that humans had screwed things up. You know, whenever we would move from place to place, we would screw things up. We'd ruin environments and things. And then through our own, by the crises that we caused, we would figure out how to live in balance with that environment. And so there's a whole variety of different kinds of hunting-gathering societies and other kinds of societies. But essentially, everything went south. That all those societies were largely egalitarian and structurally functional. And everything went south when we started engaging in concentrated, settled agriculture, the agricultural revolution 10,000 years ago. And that when we began participating in that kind of agriculture, what happened, particularly in places in the northern climates where there were times of the year where you couldn't grow things, so you had to store food. And so somebody would have the ability to lock up the food. And the person who locked up the food had the power, because food is power. If you know, you gotta eat. And so then the people who locked up the food not only had the power, but eventually created these things called kingdoms. And they became kings and queens, and they created social structures. And it all had to do with locking up the food. And all the metaphors for food, or not metaphors for food, but the things associated with it. Basically, money was a way of, you know, a representation of food, and et cetera. And so Quinn's hypothesis or suggestion, and I'm sure I'm not doing it justice, which is why I strongly recommend that you read Ishmael by Daniel Quinn rather than just take this, you know, 2-minute summary from me. I wrote a chapter about something very similar to this in my book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. But Daniel Quinn did a much better job than I did with it. And Quinn's hypothesis was that when we started engaging in agriculture 10,000 years ago, we became mentally ill. We started creating societies, hierarchical and patriarchal societies that were mentally ill. And that until we figure that out and break that mental illness, we're going to continue to make a mess of the world. And that we're unhappy as a consequence of that as well. And that a lot of these Aboriginal and Indigenous people, when you confront them with Western society and say, you know, wouldn't you love to come and live in New York City? They say, no, thank you very much. And this is where I stepped off from Quinn. In my book, Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, I talked about how there was this, it's been largely written out of our history books, but it's there if you look for it. And if you talk to anybody who's a scholar of the 17th century in North America, the 1600s in North America, after the Jamestown disaster, the early settlement of North America by Europeans, what you discover is that there was this huge phenomena of people coming over from Europe. You know, Jamestown was the East India Company's attempt to settle North America. They were all employees of the East India Company. And right. The East India Company owned Virginia. They named it after the Virgin Queen, who was the largest stockholder, et cetera, et cetera. And there was and so a lot of these people were coming over basically looking for work. They were the working poor, and they were working for the East India Company. And life was pretty crummy for them. And they came over here, and they just melded into the Indian communities. They became what were called white Indians. And many of the Native American communities welcomed these people with open arms and took them in, and they became part of their societies. And it was a real problem for many of the early, during the first 30, 40, 50 years of settlement of North America, of these, quote, white Indians, of the best and the brightest among the European immigrants into the United States, choosing to live the non-literate, non-mechanical, non-agricultural lifestyle with the Native Americans. So your question, would the Indians have ever invented the internal combustion engine? I don't honestly know the answer to that, and I think probably the Cherokee would have, because they were settled and agricultural and they had a language. and they had writing, and they were even publishing a newspaper by, you know, the mid-1600s. But I think that some of the Plains Indians probably never would have. So it's an interesting question. It's, I hope I've taken a good shot at giving it an answer, Michael. Thanks for the call, and thanks for raising it. It doesn't have anything to do with inferiority or superiority. This is culture.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Except that you could argue, and Quinn does fairly cogently in Ishmael, that the hunter-gatherer societies are superior to the agricultural societies because people are happier. Hey, just a reminder, my associate producer emeritus Jacob Dean is competing for a Democracy for America scholarship to attend Netroots Nation. There's only a few days left to go, and if you'd like to vote for him, show him your support. If you remember all the years that Jacob worked on this program, he's a good guy, and he had to go back to Portland when we moved to Washington, D.C. He followed us, actually, for a year, and then he had a family emergency and had to go back to Portland, which is where he's living now. You can vote for him at nn13.democracyforamerica.com. That's nn13.democracyforamerica.com. All it takes is a couple of seconds to share your vote, and thank you for supporting our guy, Jacob Dean, my friend, our associate producer, our associate producer emeritus. Dan, in Arvada, Colorado, listening on AM 760. Hey, Dan, what's up?
Thanks for taking my call, Tom.
Sure.
I was listening to you talk about the new president of the NRA earlier, and I'm ashamed to say that I'm a life member of the NRA. I joined about 25 or 30 years ago, and I wonder what you think. I don't think there are that many crazy people in the NRA. I wonder, can I ask for my money back? get a class action lawsuit going to throw the crazy bums out and have the more reasonable people take charge?
I don't have a clue, Dan. I don't know how their bylaws are structured. I don't know whether members are actual members, whether they actually have voting membership rights, or whether the board runs the organization and the members are merely, you know, members, basically, and don't have any power. Different organizations, pardon me, are constructed in different ways, and I'm guessing if you've never gotten a ballot or an opportunity to vote on anything, that being a member merely means you're a supporter. And but if you were to call the NRA and ask them if you could get your money back, or tell them that you'd like to resign your lifetime membership because they've gone insane or whatever, and give us a call, let us know what happens.
I'll do it. I just can't believe they have somebody that wacky calling to arms.
The War of Northern Aggression. Yep, that's what it was. Yes, indeed. Dan, thanks a lot for the call. Yeah, I was a member of the NRA for a couple of years, and I just, you know, never renewed it. But I never did the lifetime membership thing. That's a big deal. John in Albuquerque, New Mexico, listening on KABQ. Hey, John, what's up?
Well, I had a couple of topics. You know, I'm a formerly suicidal, left brain, middle aged architect in Albuquerque.
Okay.
And you forgot to note in that story about middle aged suicide that guns are involved in almost half of the suicides.
Yeah, they actually here's an interesting thing. They mentioned guns in the article, and they noted that the CDC was not by law allowed to collect gun ownership statistics, and therefore was not able to look at the relationship between suicide rates and the prevalence of firearms. So
they just noted how many were used.
CDC just didn't reference them at all in this study. Yeah.
Now my other topic was geeky art and science.
Mm-hmm.
You were talking about left brain, right brain earlier.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you'd read Betty Edwards' Drawing on the Right Side of the Brain.
No, I haven't.
And that's she teaches drawing using techniques to call upon your right brain to help you coordinate your hand with your eye.
Hmm.
And she gets some fantastic results of teaching people how to draw that way.
Would this be just, the simple stuff that comes to mind immediately would be wearing an eye patch over your left eye and drawing with your left, or over your right eye rather, drawing with your left hand. Is it that kind of thing, or is it something else altogether, like listening to music while you're drawing, or, you know, that would stimulate?
It's actually like automatic drawing, where you put your pencil on the paper, and you look at the object, and then you start moving the pencil to draw the object without taking it off of the paper at all.
Right, and without looking.
And you never get your eyes on the paper.
Right. Yeah, that's very interesting. For people who don't know what you're talking about, it's kind of a variation of what's called automatic writing, which was a huge fad in the mid-1800s in the United States. There were a number of books that were published, metaphysical books that were published, using this technique called automatic writing, where the person would usually they put their hand through a small curtain on their desk so they couldn't see their hand in the paper. And then they would just start writing, and the idea was that they were channeling, you know, very often another entity would come through and claim that it was the person, or, you know, they're unconscious. There were a lot of different theories about automatic writing. Neil Donald Walsh, when he wrote his Conversations with God books, claimed that he was using automatic writing to write them, which is a variation of automatic drawing. No, I'm not familiar with that. Betty Edwards. Drawing from the left side of the brain.
And her website is drawright.com.
Drawright. Okay. So it would be drawing from the right side of the brain, right? Not the left side.
Drawing on the right side of the brain.
Drawing on the right side of the brain. Okay, cool. I'll have to check it out. John, thanks a lot for the heads up. That's fascinating. I'm telling you, we have the smartest listeners on earth. It's so much fun doing this radio program and hanging out with y'all. Joaquin in Aiken, South Carolina.
Hello.
Am I saying your name right?
Mr. Harmon.
Yes, sir.
Yes. I'm sure you had this question addressed to you maybe 1,000 times.
Mm-hmm.
But I never heard your reply.
Okay.
How you feel about Mr. Obama getting the Social Security as a bargain chip in order to negotiate with the Republican to reduce the debt?
I think it's insane. I think it's a mistake. I think it's tragic. I think he's hurt the Democratic Party. I think he's hurt himself. I think he's hurting Social Security. He keeps trying to do things to make the Republicans behave like him, go along with him, do the best thing for the country, fill in the blanks. And I think that some of the strategists in the White House believe that if the American people see Obama as the reasonable adult in the room, and they get it that the Republicans are not. They're petulant, selfish children who are acting only on behalf of very rich people and screwing the average person. Eventually, the American people will say enough already, and they will vote the Republican bums out, and the president will end up with a Democratic majority in the Senate and the House. I understand that that's the thinking behind this. That's the strategy, I believe that that's the strategy. The people that I know people in the White House, or who know people who, you know, hang out with the political intellectuals in this town, you know, this is what I've heard repeatedly. I don't think it's a good strategy. I think that you fight for what you stand for. You put your flag in the ground and you just say, I'm standing here, and you don't step over to the other side and give them something without them even offering to give you anything. I mean, the Republicans have made it very clear they're not going to raise taxes at all on anybody, especially rich people. Well, actually, they were perfectly willing to raise taxes on working people. January 1st, they raised taxes 2% on everybody in America making under $130,000 a year. But they were unwilling to raise taxes on anybody making over $130,000 a year. And so, you know, I wish that a different set of political strategists were running the Obama administration, or that I'm wrong in my analysis. I mean, it may well be that in the 2014 elections, we're going to see that President Obama's strategy worked brilliantly, and the House will go back, you know, Nancy Pelosi will be Speaker of the House again. I hope I'm wrong and that's what happens. But my sense of it is that he has, by doing this, by endorsing this chain CPI, these cuts in Social Security. I mean, when you've got Michelle Bachmann attacking you for cutting Social Security, somebody who has spent her whole entire life basically trying to turn Social Security over to Wall Street, When you've got Michelle Bachmann attacking you for cutting Social Security, I think that's pretty good proof that the Republicans are going to use this to beat up Democrats, and explicitly and specifically the president, but Democrats by proxy. I mean, they will attack the president, and they'll put him in the ad with the local Democrats, and they're going to reduce his ability to show up in Democratic districts, you know, tight districts, tight races, and help Democratic candidates by doing that, by portraying him as the anti-Social Security guy, when actually I don't think he is the anti-Social Security guy. But I just think, anyhow, end of rant. Joaquin, thanks for the call. John in Cayucos, California. John, you got a minute before the break. You had a quick point?
Yeah, Cayucos. Yeah, real quick. I think that the Republicans are just trying to lower the expectations of all of us so they can take advantage of all of us.
Well, of course.
Instead of not just minorities, but all of us, because you have to start being disappointed at an early age so they control you, so, you know, at this point early in life, so they can control you for the rest of it. At
well,
some
this,
point,
this
when
is,
we come to expect less, the suicide rate will go down.
Yeah, yeah, I think that you're right, and I think that that's why the suicide rate is so high right now among 35 to 64 year old people, is because they're the ones who were born, you know, before Reaganomics, and they're the ones who actually expected that life would be getting better and better and better, and they're watching life fall apart around them. And the young people came in listening to President Reagan say, you know, the government is the enemy and Social Security is not going to be here for you, and, you know, everything is, you know, just let the billionaires run things and get your job at McDonald's and be happy. And I think there's a lot to what you're saying, John. Thanks a lot for the call. A very, very cogent observation. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Satellite Network. We'll be back 45 minutes. Yes.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And you can also drop into our free live chat room over at TomHartman.com. It's a hoot, and it's one of the finest, most fascinating places in cyberspace. Hey, thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to my executive producer, Sean Taylor, to our associate producers, Shane Farnan and Danielle Gilday, to our video director, Jim Javinsky, to our writer-researcher, Andrew Campbell and Nate Sweet, to Alva Goldbook for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, to our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, to all the great folks at the various companies that syndicate this program, Dial Global on commercial radio stations, Pacifica Radio on non-profit stations around the United States, around the world, Sirius XM Satellite Radio, CRN Network on cable TV systems all across the country, Free Speech TV Network on Dish Network, DirecTV, all the cable providers who carry our program, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Network, all the others around the country, all the great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on the big picture, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, the folks in our chat room, to Ellen Ratner and Victoria Jones, and everyone at the Talk Radio News Service, and to Jay Goodman Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for supporting our program. Thank you. Thank you. It's truly appreciated. Dustin in Batesville, Arkansas. Hey, Dustin, welcome to the program.
Yes, hey.
You had a question? Dustin? I think Dustin's phone just croaked on him. Yeah, he might have dropped an obscenity if he did. My apologies if it made its way through. Margie in Wisconsin Rapids, Wisconsin. Actually, you know, Margie, before I pick up your call, Dustin, it had said what Dustin had asked Danielle was, would Congress work better if elected officials were picked like members of a jury? And that's actually how democracy ran in Greece. That's how it was done. Everybody put their name into the pool, and 6,000 people had to show up every so often to make laws. And if you, as part of, you know, as one of the people whose name was in the pool, you were part of the polis, the P-O-L-I-S, which is the basis of the word politics and politician and everything else. And if you didn't show up when your name was pulled, if you ignored that year and you didn't do the equivalent of jury duty, if you didn't do that, you were referred to in the Greek language as an idiota, I-D-I-O-T-A, which is where the word idiot came from, or arguably one of the sources of the word idiot, was a person who refused to show up and participate in the political process. So anyhow, in answer to his question, even if I think his phone was croaking and he was swearing at his phone, not at us. Margie in Wisconsin Rapids, Wisconsin. Hey, Margie, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to make you aware that a few years ago, the federal government allowed yet another business to become too big to fail. And that is a truck stop chain.
Really?
And Pilot was allowed to buy out Flying J from bankruptcy, and they are now more than twice the size of the next largest truck stop chain.
Huh.
Now, reason that this is important now is last month, the headquarters in Knoxville, Tennessee, were raided by the FBI and the IRS. And I believe they are looking at charges. The possibility is fraud and racketeering. Just so you know, the CEO happens to be the brother of the governor of Tennessee. The governor used to be the CEO of this company.
Yeah.
Now, the reason that they're going to be too big to fail is even if they are convicted, there is no way that the government can shut this business down because it will stop transportation in the U.S. Not only will we not be able to fuel our trucks, but we won't be able to take our mandatory DOT breaks.
Right. Now, don't you think, though, Margie, that what happened when AT&T got broken up, for example, or even going back to the Taft administration, Teddy Roosevelt started it, but Taft finished it when he broke up Standard Oil, is that there were all these small refineries that Standard Oil could no longer own, and small entrepreneurs came in and owned them, bought them.
I would support that, except the problem is it would take too long.
Mm-hmm.
There are places like Fort Pierce, Florida, there's three truck stops. Two of them are Pilots. One of them is a Flying J. There is nothing else between Jacksonville, Florida, and Fort Lauderdale.
Wow.
That's just one example.
Wow.
And that, it could become a big issue in the next year.
Yeah. That's fascinating. Well, this is an example of what happens when the Sherman Antitrust Act is not enforced and companies are allowed to become too big to fail. Margie, thanks for sharing that with us. I appreciate it. Thanks for the call, and thanks for listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. I'm assuming you must be a trucker. David in Silver Springs, Florida. Hey, David, last minute of the show. You have a quick question?
Yeah, I have a question. You're probably somebody going to laugh about it, but I want to know why nothing has been done to bring Bush and Cheney up before the Hague on criminal charges of
there was actually a Spanish judge who was going to try and do this a year or so ago, and the Obama administration put a lot of pressure on the Spanish government, and the judge backed off. I think that the failure to prosecute the Nixon administration for their crimes with perpetuating the Vietnam War in order to beat Hubert Humphrey in 68, the failure to prosecute the Reagan administration for Iran-Contra and cutting a special deal with the Ayatollah, the failure to prosecute the Bush-Cheney administration for Iraq and Afghanistan. I think these are all, I think Gerry Ford established a very bad precedent when he pardoned Nixon and all of his buddies for all crimes. And now this is just what presidents do, and I think it's a bad thing, but I'm not running the country. Coming up Monday on the program, we'll have all the latest news over the weekend, and Congress is back in session, so we'll have up-to-the-minute news from the Hill, too, and the best of the rest of the news. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it. Go to free-don.com.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.